ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brann. Welcome to the program. The ban on social media for kids under the age of 16 comes as thousands of boarding school students head home for Christmas. And the Boarding Schools Association has got a few concerns.
They're going to be, of course, at home on holidays when this ban starts, and then potentially have, you know, their way of connecting with their friends cut off completely.
Also today, a look at how Australia has managed to export a record amount of beef in 2025. And let's keep talking about Territory Milk. We've been reminiscing about the history of dairy farms in the Top End this week. Well, today you'll learn about some of the dairy farms that used to operate in the Red Centre.
We had a Jersey stud and an Anglo-Nubian stud, and Browns, I believe, I could be wrong, I reckon they had Frisians mostly.
These stories and plenty more coming up on today's Country Hour. Hope you can stick around. This is the Country Hour. We're broadcasting right across the territory on the ABC. And a reminder, if you do need to duck out into the paddock for whatever reason, or maybe the reception's getting a bit dodgy on that road you're on, you can always download our podcast and listen at a time that suits you. Now, if you love rambutans, then I've got some good news for you. The season is ramping up for veteran grower Kerry Upini. It's actually been a bit of a challenging start to the harvest. His orchard has copped plenty of storms and, of course, an early cyclone. Fiona Broom went to Kerry's farm to see how his rambutan trees fared during Cyclone Fina.
Thankfully, the superstructure, which includes lots of fixed netting, has been good. It stood up well, but we lost a number of branches. And, of course, the branches we lost were all heavily laden with fruit. So from that point of view, we lost quite a bit of fruit that would have been ready for harvest in the next week or so. So it did set us back that way. And of course, we had a cold room which had a lot of fruit in it at that stage. So that became a bit of a problem too. So eventually got rid of some, but not all of it.
Did you lose power to that cool room?
Oh yeah, we lost power for 3 days, but we then had generators come in and sort of supported us through the period. But there was trucks issues and things of that nature. So yeah, it wasn't great, but it wasn't sort of dramatically bad.
There'd been some other storms that had come through the rural area as well, previous to Tropical Cyclone Fina. Did you cop any damage from those?
Yeah, the gusty ones certainly had an effect on some of the trees. And there again, it was the heavily laden branches that came down. So, yeah, it's been a bit of a setback from that point of view too.
In the context of the season, with those storms and it's been pretty wet, how's the season going for the rambutans here?
Well, it's not too bad, but interestingly, it's been a very patchy season with early flowering and quite a bit of flowering, but probably a poor set for some trees. In fact, there are some trees that didn't set any fruit, but there again, we have plenty of trees that have set a lot of fruit. So you wouldn't say that overall it's a great season, but it's steady.
Is it looking to be a longer season? You've still got some new fruit coming on here, you said?
Yeah, it does. It looks as though that will go on for a couple of months. Although we're probably in the peak of it now, and there has been a lot of fruit on the market, a lot of Northern Territory rambutan on the southern markets, so because that's a reflection on the fact that there's more growers than ever before, I think. Well, in recent years might be a better term. So that brought prices back a bit, but generally demand's been very good on the markets.
So the commercial rambutan sector, is it developing, growing here in the Northern Territory?
Yes, there's an increasing number of people interested in growing rambutans, but of course the holdback is the amount of infrastructure you need with the fixed netting and the poles and all of that go with rambutans, because unless you've got bird protection, then you don't have a crop.
There's all kinds of birds pottering around outside the netting here. So do orangutans attract birds?
Sure do. Sure do. And, you know, sometimes it attracts them to the extent that they're happy to chew through the net to get a feast of orangutans. And once they're through, then everything follows them in. So generally, if we can keep them outside and have them looking in, it's okay. But once they get in, it's very hard to stop them. They're very clever. They'll find any little hole, any little spot that you've left neglected, and they'll be in there in a flash. We've had fixed netting here for probably 30 plus years, so we've got it down to a pretty fine art. But generally, it does need maintenance and all year round. So we go about repairing nets, stabilising the poles, tensioning up our cables, etc. every year. So it's an ongoing job.
Are new growers coming to you for advice moving into this industry?
Yeah, I do get a number of inquiries for, you know, advice on growing and some marketing, but also, say, if they're applying for some grants and people who have English as a second language sometimes come to me to help them fill out the forms and get the paperwork in place. So, yeah, we do talk to other growers, and we encourage them to enter the industry.
You do have other crops here. You've got some citrus. How are they going this season?
Yeah, there again, it's a strange season. Like, normally we'd be inundated with limes at this time of year, and they're not there. There's some that are flowering now, which is well out of their normal range. So it's been generally an unusual year all around. So limes are down. Pomelos seem to be having a good year. They're not harvesting them yet, but there seem to be plenty on the trees. So we're hoping that, you know, the diversification helps us. If one thing goes down, the other thing comes up. So let's hope so.
And we are into December now. We're in the run-up to Christmas. So are we expecting demand to be good for the orangutans, the Christmas fruits?
Oh, exactly. And all we have to do is organise the trees to produce during that period. So he's hoping we'll have some fruit. But, you know, it's one of those things you just cannot foretell, or you cannot have any guidance on the trees to produce at exactly the right time. But generally, it's looking as though we'll have some to make people's Christmas happier.
That is Kerry Yupini, who grows rambutans, limes and pomelos at his place in Darwin's rural area. Rambutans, one of the most Christmassy fruits I can think of in the Northern Territory. Sweet, beautiful, and look like a Christmas bauble. It's got everything. It is 22 to 1. You are tuned into the Country Hour. The year is not over yet, but already Australia has broken a big, beefy record. I'll tell you more next after some Slim.
Whoa, bullocks, whoa there. Moving nice and slow, moving nice and slow. Whoa, bullocks, whoa there, you bullocks.
Andrew Dalgleish, Foxalicious Fruit, just out of Catherine. When I get a spare moment on the tractor, I like listening to Matt and the team on the Country Hour.
Now, the year isn't over yet, but already Australia has broken the record for most amount of beef exported in a calendar year. Australia has sold nearly 1.4 million tonnes of beef to customers around the world between January and November, which is up 15% year on year. Tim Jackson from Meat and Livestock Australia says Australia's been producing record amounts of beef this year, and overseas demand has been snapping it up, especially the United States.
US production has been falling this year, and so that's pushed up their import demand. And that's had an effect on beef markets globally. So their exports have gone down and their imports have gone up. That's meant that the United States so far, like in this year so far, has been the biggest single market so far. Exports are up 17% year on year from last year to just over 400,000 tonnes. But it's also meant, because there's, you know, relatively less US beef for export, that there's a little bit more space for Australian beef in the market. So the US has been quite important in that sort of effect.
The 10% tariff introduced earlier in the year, which is now gone in the end. Did that 10% tariff mean anything?
Oh, it's still really difficult to say, because those supply dynamics are really powerful. And we've seen in the US really robust demand for beef. We've seen, you know, even with pretty high pricing of American cattle and American beef, we've seen American beef demand at really, really high levels. And so in the context where, you know, their domestic production is short and demand is really high, those kind of dynamics have ended up being really important in terms of how the trades went. And so it's really hard to then break the tariff effect out from that.
If American consumers had balked at higher prices, it could have been a very different story, but they were willing to pay, and hence the beef kept flowing.
Yeah, they were willing to pay, and demand in the US has been really good. And, you know, Australia exports to in terms of red meat generally over 100 markets. So while the US has been really important, it's not the only market. And we've seen quite strong demand right across our major markets. And we've seen strong growth in a lot of the smaller kind of more emerging markets. So it's been, yeah, big volumes across the board, really.
Exports into Greater China up 37%. Is that right?
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
So up 37%. And again, the US is an exporter into China. And so we've been able to build some market share over them, both because of the US supply shortage and because of some kind of trade hiccups that have been going on there. But then,
well, you say hiccups, but it almost looks like a ban, really. They have not been able to export any beef to China this year.
Yeah. Oh, look, we'll see how it goes with that. But I mean, the fact is that we've seen, you know, strong demand for beef, like Australian beef in China. And again, there are those kind of supply demand dynamics, those big picture macro sorts of things. But then also, like, Australia's reputation in market is really strong.
If you're tuning in, this is the Country Hour, and we're talking beef with Tim Jackson from Meat and Livestock Australia. So Australia is producing record amounts of beef. It's exporting record amounts of beef. And the slaughter numbers this year, Tim, have been, well, they've been massive. Is Australia chewing into its own herd?
So we're on the last projections that we did, which came out in September, we forecast a kind of slight, like a marginal herd destocking. So the size of the herd coming down a little bit, but not particularly substantially. We've seen supply being, you know, really quite strong this year. Slaughter numbers have been, like you say, really quite high. And we put that down to, you know, in some parts of the country, pretty good seasons now for up to, you know, 5 years in a row. And in other parts, obviously, there's been, like, conditions have been pretty different. But on the whole, because we had that really strong herd rebuild right around the country in, you know, 2020, 21, 22, and then kind of since then, we've actually not had bad seasons. We haven't had that big sell-off and that big liquidation. We're now saying that this kind of big mature herd, which is able to turn off really substantial volumes, like really big numbers of cattle, which is then flowing through to big numbers of production. And I think the other thing to note here, because we're talking about exports, which is ultimately about tons of beef, is that carcass weights have remained really high, and that's contributed then to the high production export numbers.
Yes, as in, it's actually not a record amount of cattle that have been killed this year, but what has been killed has produced a record amount of beef.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so, and you know, there are a lot of different reasons for that, because, you know, on the one hand, like, we've seen, you know, a bit of a change in the genetic profile of the herd, changes in management practices on farm, all those sorts of things which are contributing to heavier carcass weights, which flow into production. And of course, you have to look at, you know, the feedlot sector. And so you can kind of see that in the sense that, you know, feedlot capacity has been rising, national capacity has been rising, turnoff has been rising, and that contributes to the carcass weights. But then that also means that grain-fed exports have been really strong this year.
Yeah, I've got here grain-fed beef exports, again, a record and an increase of 19% year on year. Yeah, the feedlot sector just absolutely cranking. We saw record prices this year for processor cows, mostly thanks to that demand from the United States. Is it fair to say if there hadn't been dry conditions in Victoria, South Australia and parts of New South Wales, that we would have probably seen record prices across all categories?
Oh, the counterfactual's really difficult to work through because so many different factors that go into price. And so it's really, really difficult to say, you know, if we'd have different weather here, then we probably would have seen different weather in other parts of the world. And that would have then meant that, you know, production volumes look different and so on. So it's really difficult to kind of unpack all of that. But I will say, just as a basic point, that now, you know, we're looking at cattle prices, like sale yard prices, have been pretty strong, particularly over the last couple of months. They've been rising, and yeah, particularly that processor cow. But you've seen a lift, yeah, right across the market.
So just finally, for cattle producers listening to this, Tim Jackson, what's MLA expecting for 2026?
Well, we don't have a crystal ball, but I was talking about the projections earlier, and what they've currently got is for 2026 to not reach those kind of record production and export numbers, but nonetheless for slaughter to stay high, and then for that to flow through to historically high, you know, when compared against a 5 or a 10 or whatever period average, a historically high production, which then flows through to higher export volumes on the global front. US beef production is still declining. It's quite likely that we're going to see, you know, some decrease in production coming out of Brazil next year. It looks like they're reaching the top or have reached the top of their cattle cycle.
I know MLA doesn't like to talk about prices, but if global supply is tightening and if that demand stays where it is, prices should, for cattle producers in Australia, go in one way. They should.
Yeah.
Markets can do funny things.
Yeah. There's so much. There's so much that goes into it. But just to pick, you know, there's the exchange rate and the input costs and there's the consumer demand. There's so much that goes into price, which is why we don't do the forecasting. But
we can agree there's positive signs. How's that sound?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tim Jackson, thanks for your time on the Country Hour.
Thank you very much.
Tim Jackson is the Global Supply Analyst for Meat and Livestock Australia. So just repeating that headline, Australia has already broken the record for most amount of beef exported in a calendar year. And there's still a month of stats to go, but the record has already been broken. It's been a big year for beef. Australia has also been busy exporting live cattle. The other day, I spoke to cattle exporter Hamish Shannon. He said the Darwin port was on track to load up 20 ships just in the month of December.
Well, this is one of the most busiest time of the year. We're trying to all get our cattle up to Indonesia before Ramadan in February, March next year. So I think there's something like 20 boats before now to the end of the Christmas. We've got three. We've got one loading on Friday and one on Saturday, and then we've got another one on lighting on about the 24th out of Darwin. So it's a very busy time of year. It's a lot of floodplain cattle coming in. This set of yards we're sending in now is full of our floodplain cattle from multiple properties. So yeah, very busy time of the year.
Yeah, I think I heard 20 boats in 20 days. Does that mean every live export ship in the industry's just doing the Darwin to Indonesian run?
Yes, pretty much at the moment, yes. Yeah, every livestock vessel is running out of Darwin at the moment. So yeah, it's crazy times, but yes.
That is cattle exporter Hamish Shannon speaking to me the other day at the Berrima Export Yards. Shout out to everyone involved in the live export trade. It's a busy time for the boats, the trucks, the yards, and everything in between. It is 8 to 1. You are tuned into the Country Hour.
Hi, my name's Luke Barbetti. I'm the underground mining manager at Newmont's Tanami operation. I'm responsible for all the activities underground. What I enjoy about working at the Tanami are the people and the really strong culture that we have. You're listening to the Country Hour.
And let's turn our attention now to the resources sector. As global lithium prices continue to rebound after a major market crash last year, one company is forging ahead with its plans for a new underground mine in the Northern Territory. The company Lithium Plus wants to extract 3 million tonnes of the critical mineral over 7 years from its Leigh project, which is located on the Cox Peninsula, about 50 kilometres from Darwin. To learn more about the plans, Sam Parry had a chat to company director Simon Kidston.
So the Leigh deposit is just outside of Darwin. It's about 50 kilometres as the crow flies. And we've identified a very high-grade lithium deposit, which we're seeking to bring into production as soon as the economics allow it.
What are those economics like at the moment? I mean, we've seen Core Lithium have wound down their production until the conditions improve. Is there a sense of where the market is heading?
The lithium price is extremely volatile. A couple of years ago, it was trading at $7,000 a ton. 6 months ago, it was languishing at $700 a ton. So it's enormously volatile. But what's underpinning it, of course, is the whole electrification of everything. And of course, electric vehicles are a big part of that. So the demand for the commodity is enormous, and Australia is really in a very good place to be a supplier, a reliable supplier of lithium to the world. So the price is still lowish at the moment, around $1,100 a ton, but I believe it's trending upwards, which would support the start of our mine and potentially the restart of the coal mines.
So heading towards the end of 2025, what have you been able to achieve to progress the Leigh project this year, and what are you hoping for next year?
So we have submitted a mining license application to the Northern Territory government. They've approved that, and we are now working on the environmental authority. So we're busy doing the studies required to demonstrate that the impact on the environment is very low, and to the extent there is an impact, that impact can be mitigated. So we would expect to lodge the information to the government that they need to make their assessment in the first quarter of calendar year 26, and typically it takes about 6 months for the government to consider that information and provide their environmental authority.
In the publicly available documents, it looks like the EPA are seeking a lot more information on this project, particularly when it comes to things like water monitoring, traffic, and cultural considerations. But I guess one of the big things they were seeking more information on was the rehabilitation plans for the mine. Have you been working to create a plan for after the Leigh project's 7-year life?
Look, we have, and you know, I'd like to think that we will adopt best practice here and leave minimal environmental impact. So primarily, this is an underground mining operation, so the impact on the surface will be very low. There will be some surface infrastructure, obviously, but frankly, it's minimal impact. All the mining activity would occur underground, and there would be no noise or dust impact whatsoever. On the surface, there would be a couple of sheds, there would be a pond to manage the sort of the water balance on the site. There would be a small amount of clearing, obviously, to make room for the tunnel portal, some roads, some sheds, but frankly, very, very little disturbance at all.
Could you just describe how you actually extract the lithium out of the land? And then I assume you dig it up and then it's processed in some way before it's being shipped?
Yeah, what we're proposing is to ship and to export raw, unprocessed rock. So this is essentially an underground portal, so a tunnel from surface to go down to where the ore body is located. The rock is mined, or the mineralized rock is mined. It's crushed, and then that raw, unprocessed rock is put on a on a truck, taken to the port and exported to China for processing there.
And so what's next? What are the final steps to going into production after you've finalised all of the studies for the environmental approval?
If we were in a position to receive our environmental authority by, say, late next year, there would be no barrier then to starting the project other than economics. So provided the price of the lithium spodumene is supportive of new development, we would then access the capital from the market to build the mine and then start the mining process.
That is Simon Kidston, who is the director of Lithium Plus Minerals, speaking to Sam Parry about the company's plans for lithium mining on the Cox Peninsula. As we go to air this afternoon, shares in Lithium Plus, well, they have not moved. They are sitting at 14 cents a share this afternoon. Year to date, the company's share price has risen by 75%.
Keep your garden growing strong with ABC Organic Gardener magazine. Inside, you'll find summer pruning advice, organic pest solutions, and our expert guide to eggplants at newsagents or abcmagazines.com.au.
Yo, Namre. My name's Gorgoro Hick. I work for Dimuru Aboriginal Corporation in Northeast Arnhem Land. One of our mottos is Nilamuru Bukmatjaka Wangao, meaning all of us together looking after country. And you're listening to Country Hour on ABC.
Our text number at the Country Hour is 0487 99 1057. On our earlier story about record amounts of beef being shipped overseas and some record prices for Aussie cattle producers, someone here on the text says all these record prices and it only benefits the top end of town. And at what cost? Land clearing, environmental, shipping, the list goes on. Is it really necessary? Says someone here on the text. No name attached to it. I'd argue that this is not just benefiting the top end of town. There's farming families right across this nation who this year have been able to sell cattle and also sheep and lambs at good money. And they need that money because the inputs are on the rise as well. So these prices are helping farming families right across the nation. And if they're not getting those sort of dollars, then all of a sudden it doesn't become viable. And then what? Anyway, just my thoughts. Just my thoughts. I'm looking at top end radars and whoa, there's some really big rain way off the coast, but there's some communities along the northern coastline getting a decent drop as well. There's been over 100 millimetres at Cape Wessel. I'll be speaking to the Weather Bureau in 5 minutes' time to get the latest. But now let's head to the newsroom, 1 o'clock.
Hi, I'm Casey Townsend from Hazard Station. We have the Little Miniature Cattle and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. The ban on social media for kids under the age of 16. It's in force as of today. And it comes as thousands of boarding school students head home for Christmas. The Boarding Schools Association has got a few concerns.
They're going to be, of course, at home on holidays when this ban starts, and then potentially have, you know, their way of connecting with their friends cut off completely.
And let's keep talking about Territory Milk. We've been reminiscing about the history of dairy farms in the Top End this week, and I've loved it. I hope you have been enjoying the stories as well. Before 1:30, you'll learn about some of the dairy farms that used to operate at the other end of the Northern Territory, in the Red Centre.
We had a Jersey stud and an Anglo-Nubian stud, and Browns, I believe, once again, I could be wrong, I reckon they had Frisians mostly.
Let's go to the Weather Bureau first. Rebecca Patrick's there this afternoon. How are you, Beck?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you, Matt.
There's a bit of rain along the northern coastline.
Yeah, that's right. Cape Wessel, which is off that northeastern corner of the territory, furthest north location that we have, 106 millimetres to 9 a.m. this morning. But elsewhere on the mainland, Tortilla Flats on the Adelaide River, 62 millimetres, Banban Springs with 56, Howley Creek with 55, so some good falls down through the Daly district.
Tipperary Cattle Station, 44 in the gauge. Decent.
Yeah,
and Jabiru, 38.
Mm. Yep, some good falls there. Had a little bit around the Victoria River area, Victoria River Downs with 20 millimetres. Timber Creek only got about 3, so not quite so much. And then further south, there was a few sprinkles around as well. Tennant Creek picked up about 5 millimetres as well.
I'll mention Mount Sanford Cattle Station, 18 in the gauge there for the Heytesbury, from memory, own that station these. Yeah, so a bit of rain around. Is there more to come?
Yeah, so at the moment, just looking at the satellite image and radars, most of the action around the north coast, with a few showers and storms forming up there and over the Tiwis. Also a bit of action in the Lassa district, so between about Kintore and Papunya, with some storms firing up through there right now. But during the afternoon, could see storms through most parts of the territory at some stage. Had a bit of action around the southern parts of the Barkly this morning, so that might take a bit to get that energy back in the atmosphere to put out something else again, but maybe more the eastern parts might see something this afternoon. And then down through the Gregory district again and across the top end should start to see a few storms this afternoon across the western parts.
Fiona Broom, our producer and reporter, is over on the Tiwis today for a fantastic story, but it looks wet over there at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. Depending where she is, but yeah, there's quite a bit of thunderstorm activity up there right now. So yeah, hope she's taking cover.
Yeah. Let's talk about further south. The heatwave warning still in place today for the Simpson and Lassiter districts. It's still uncomfortable in many spots.
Yeah, Alice Springs has already hit 40 degrees. Today, looking at top of 41, might even nudge a bit higher than that, I think. But yeah, generally looking at those low 40s across the southern districts today and continuing for another couple of days as well, within that sort of northeast to northwesterly flow right throughout those central and southern districts.
Anything else we should be aware of this afternoon?
Not a lot. Not expecting too much rainfall out of those storms in the south. So south of about Tennant Creek, could see gusty storms if they're about, but not a lot of rain from them. So just be aware of that. But yeah, mainly it's the heat in the south that's the main consideration today.
Okay, thanks so much for your time.
No worries. Thanks, Matt.
It is 1:10, and you are tuned into the Country Hour. Just before the 1 o'clock news, you heard from the company Lithium Plus Minerals. It's got plans to build an underground lithium mine on the Cox Peninsula near Darwin, about 50 kilometres as the crow flies from Darwin. A few text messages here from you about that proposal. Someone here says, yep, the transportation of ore is a big concern before any mining takes place out there, because when Core Lithium was up and going, it had quad road trains on the Cox Peninsula Road, and it was bloody dangerous for everyone on that road, says someone here this afternoon. And someone here is letting me know about the death of a country music legend. So I've got here the frontman of the Mavericks, Raoul Marlow, has died at the age of 60. I've got to say, I'm not aware of the Mavericks' work. Producer Sam, have you come across a few tunes from the Mavericks? No. They've won a few Grammys over the years. Thanks for letting me know about his passing, and I'll see if I can find one of their best tunes.
Hello, my name is John Mangold Maureen, and we are here at Lighthouse at Hurley Beach. I worked for the Canberra Ranger for 6 years. You're listening to the Country Hour on ABC.
The world's first social media ban for children under 16 years of age has come into effect across Australia today. In a moment, here on the Country Hour, you'll hear from the Australian Boarding Schools Association. But first, let's hear from Sally Brindle, who is the Federal Vice President of the Isolated Children's Parents Association. She says some ICPA members living in remote areas have expressed concerns about the rollout of this ban and how it could impact bush families.
The association doesn't have a particular stance for or against this issue because we feel there are a lot of areas that affect people differently depending on where you live and how you live. You know, we want to keep our children safe from online harms, but that has to be weighed up against people and children being able to stay connected. And especially as this is something that a lot of these kids have grown up with, and now it's going to be taken away.
So what sort of discussions have you been having with other parents and members of the ICPA?
A lot of the discussions have focused around possibly a lack of consultation. Were there other alternatives that could have been looked at rather than prohibition? Could there have been more done around, you know, education on the usage of social media in a correct and proper manner? Then on the other side, there have been some conversations around maybe it'll help our children to be more connected on a face-to-face level.
How could this affect children who are going to be impacted by it if they're under 16?
So I think for a lot of our members, the timing is probably one issue that really could have been considered better. You know, the start of the school holiday for our families, especially those who have children away at boarding school, they have friends from all over Australia. Now their means of connection is being taken away from them at a time when they're going home to environments when they're isolated from face-to-face connections with their friends, and now the means that they were using to connect is being taken away from them.
So when would be a good time to do this? Is there ever a good time?
I don't know if there ever is a good time. And like I said before, I just wonder, is prohibition really the right avenue to take? We don't want things to be driven underground. Children are very clever. Children are very tech savvy. You know, are there going to be emerging new platforms that the children can adopt to basically achieve the same thing that they're currently already doing? And how is the government going to keep on top of all those other platforms that come on board in terms of making sure that if they want to continue with this ban, that those platforms are held accountable as well? So I just feel that a prohibition is going to be very hard to police in terms of keeping up with how fast technology can move.
That is Sally Brindle, who's the Vice President of the Isolated Children's Parents Association, speaking to Kate Forrester. This ban on social media for kids under the age of 16, it comes as thousands of boarding school students head back home for Christmas. Australian Boarding Schools Association Chief Executive Richard Stokes says schools have been trying to give students a few tips on how to stay connected with their mates over the Christmas period without using social media. But he admits the association does have a few concerns.
That's a real risk. We should be alert to that fact and keep our eyes open. Now, the thing that I'm really worried about, I think the timing hasn't been thought of well, because the 10th of December is when kids are going home from school. You know, they're on holidays, they're away from, you know, all of those support networks. So all of those boarders don't have that wonderful support and circle of care around them that they would have normally during term time. So they're going to be, you know, not only away from that, but then also away from all of their friends. So they can't even talk to them. You know, they'll have to find ways to do it. So we're a bit worried about that whole mental health issue in that space.
Is there anything being looked at to help transition students away from social media?
We need to do a little bit of work teaching our students how to be in contact with their friends once they're not able to do it on the social media platforms, because they use Snapchat and Instagram chat. all the time. That's how they talk to their friends. And so they're going to be, of course, at home on holidays when this ban starts, and then potentially have, you know, their way of connecting with their friends cut off completely.
Have boarding staff members seen some negative impacts of social media?
Oh, heck yes. It's one of those big challenges. And I guess one of the good things about boarding school is that by removing their devices at night, you're in a situation where you're actually sort of giving them some space to be able to do that. What we find is, you know, it's really quite fascinating. By removing the devices from the kids, then they become quite social again. You know, if I think back to my early days of working in boarding, the kids spent a lot of time doing things together, you know, both actively and even on, you know, watching TV and stuff like that. They were really good at it. And when they've got their head down on their own device, you know, being on some sort of social media platform, that really takes that away.
So boarding schools might, in fact, be a step ahead of, say, parents at home who are struggling to get the media off their children.
100%. Absolutely. Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Most of the schools would in some fashion try and give their older students, their year 11s or particularly their year 12s, the opportunity to prove that they can be more responsible with their devices, you know, and maybe leave them on weekends or even some nights during the week. But still, a lot of boarding schools are taking them away from all of the kids because, you know, it's all about sleep. One of the things that we're going to have to come to terms with is actually working on ways for kids to be in touch with their friends. You know, when I grew up, it was the phone in the middle of the house that Mum and Dad could listen to no matter who I was talking to. Or we made plans when we were at school and we then followed them through, you know, later on the day. That's definitely not the life of a teenager today. And we're going to have to actually teach them some of the skills to make sure that they can be in contact with their friends during the holidays. Otherwise, they're going to be quite lonely.
That is Richard Stokes, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Australian Boarding Schools Association. That social media ban, it's underway. On the text line this afternoon, David at Stewart Park says, regarding this social media ban, remember, email is still available. You can still text. And you can still FaceTime. And Jacko in Humpty Doo is saying, hey, next time you have a chat to the bomb, ask them about Hector. Haven't heard anything about Hector for a long time. I reckon something could be wrong, says Jacko. Well, you're right, Jacko, in that I haven't heard the Bureau mention Hector. But if you look at the radar this afternoon, well, there's some evidence that Hector's having a great old afternoon. But Jacko, I'll make sure, I'm just going to save that text of yours and we'll make sure we put that to the Weather Bureau tomorrow.
Hello, my name is Julie Roy, Acting Coordinator for Yugalmangi Rangers, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
And we've been hearing some incredible stories this week about the history of dairy farming in the Top End. We've heard about the dairy that was once up and running near Noonamar. There used to be a dairy at Nightcliff. And yesterday, we heard some great stories about the old Rollins Dairy near Katherine. Well, turns out there used to be a few dairy herds in the Red Centre as well. Rod Kramer says his family used to run some dairy cattle just south of Alice Springs. He reckons commercial production stopped in sort of the late 1980s. He had a chat to Stuart Brash about his memories of that dairy farm.
Oh, it would have been of the order of 24, and we had far more goats, but we produced far more cow's milk than goat's milk, but people only remember us for the goats, apparently.
And the cow milk was bottled. Was it sold? How was it sold? How was it distributed?
It was in bottles, because they started with goats back in about 1960, and that was bottled in old wine flagons and vinegar bottles and whatever else we could find, and delivered to customers to their door in town. And later on when we had the cows, we put in those wax coated cardboards, like used to buy granitas and milkshakes and that sort of thing. And they were sealed, and that went on for many years, and then they stopped making those, and then Dad and a guy by the name of John Harris, who was a part owner of the steakhouse at one time, they built a heat sealing machine, and it was sold in plastic bags.
Is something you don't see so often these days. But even earlier on, and I think you pointed this in a text earlier, that the Army had a dairy during the war.
Well, I've only been told that by one person, and that was Peter Latz. I'm not dubbing him in, but he told me that years ago. You know, along with their piggery and slaughterhouse and etc. But which were, neither of those were at Simpsons Gap. But I think the first, and I don't know, I stand to be corrected. The first one at White Gums. And I don't know when they closed, but it was not long before us, I think. It was definitely before us, I believe, but not how far, I don't know. And also about the same time was the Barber family, and they lived just on the town side of where Smales had their camel farm.
Out on Ross Highway. What was it called? Was it Ross Highway in those days? What was it called?
It was Emily Gap Road.
Right, there you go. And
same,
who was...
Same, many times.
Who was the biggest producer? Of all the Browns, yourselves, or
well,
the Barbers?
I imagine that Browns would have been in terms of cow's milk. But, you know, I mean, they had a lot more land than we did to start with. But we grew Lucerne to actually feed them. And John Blakeman actually grew more Lucerne for us over at Old Timers, and we used to go and harvest it. So we were able to feed for the milking cows, we would, and goats. Like the producing ones, we were able to feed them green Lucerne nearly every night.
And what breed were they?
We had a Jersey stud and an Anglo-Nubian stud. And Browns, I believe, I could be wrong, I reckon they had Frisians mostly, but I could be wrong.
Extraordinary what we used to do. And the fact that obviously refrigerated transport ended things like having local dairies.
Well, no, that didn't end it at all. It was other issues. We had refrigerated transport as far back as I can remember, getting the school milk in Tetra Paks. But often, you know, that broke down and they had a lot of milk to get rid of.
Whoa, yuck.
And we were feeding that to potty cars. But there was another dairy in Alice Springs, and I'm sitting here looking at the building now, which was run by Mrs. Turpin, and I can't remember her Christian name, Jeff. The late Jeff Turpin's mother.
Yeah.
And I've got photographs of them actually building it, which was about 1960. And they didn't have a big herd, but they were milking. They had a milking milk room, and, you know, they milked them outside under a roof or whatever. But they had a number of cows. I mean, they had enough to take it seriously to build a sandstone milk room so to keep it cool. So they must have been producing something, you know, a reasonable amount to have to do that.
Just back to the original question, though, Rod. What killed off the dairies if refrigeration from down south didn't?
Well, for us it was age and water supply and stuff like that. I can't speak for the others. The fact that, we had our milk tested, had to be tested monthly.
It was
never pasteurised, but they were never able to grow a culture in it. So it just goes to show that you don't have to have pasteurisation if you do the right thing with it and get it, you know, cool it as quickly as possible. And, there was lots of things. I mean, competition. I mean, it's the same as we had market gardens. Well, they suffered for the same reason, but the thing that killed market gardens in Alice Springs really was Tully's arriving. And the way they treated the locals it just couldn't compete.
That is Rod Kramer chatting to Stuart Brash about the history of dairy farming in Central Australia. I've loved the dairy history on the Country Hour this week, and I hope you have too. Now, as mentioned earlier, the lead singer of the country rock band The Mavericks, Rahul Marlowe, he has died aged 60. Got a text here from Brian who says, "Mate, one of my favourite bands. Sad news for sure." Brian was keen to hear the track "All You Ever Do Is Bring Me Down." I'm sorry, Brian, I haven't been able to find that song. But here is one of the classics by The Mavericks, "Dance the Night Away."
Sunny morning light, and if you tell. And if she should tell you that she wants me back, tell her no, I gotta go.
See the LA Times reporting that Raul Marlow, who as frontman of the Mavericks brought a Latin rhythmic flair and a sweeping sense of romance to country music, he has died at the age of 60. As mentioned, reporter Fiona Broome is over on the Tiwi Islands this afternoon for a very interesting story. Fiona will be hosting tomorrow's Country Hour and can tell you all about it. I'll be back here on Friday. Hope you enjoy the rest of your day. And of course, keep it rural.
And if she should tell you that she wants me back.